I'm Samir Patel, editor-in-chief at Quanta Magazine. Our mission at Quanta is to cover what we call basic or fundamental research in science and math. That means the kind of work that's driven by curiosity and discovery and the search for knowledge. We're interested in how and why everything around us works the way that it does. On our brand new show, the Quanta Podcast, you'll meet the writers and editors behind the magazine, and together we'll explore the biggest ideas and the tiniest details. Join me for the Quanta Podcast, your weekly dispatch from the frontiers of science and math.
Gulf states have denounced the war against Iran, but they've been dragged in anyway.
We are emphasizing diplomacy, dialogue, political engagement as the only sustainable path.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also, some survivors of Japanese internment camps worry about today's deep divisions.
My family lived through what happens when this fear goes unchecked.
Meanwhile, major relief for Iran's women's soccer team. Some players got asylum this week in Australia. And why Colombia is so good at getting people to exercise. Plus, in the city of spies.
We don't care what other countries do to each other on Austrian soil. This is not of our concern.
But it is a concern for those other countries. The freedom to spy in Vienna may be coming to an end. All that and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here today. As Iran gets bombarded by the U.S. and Israel, it continues to launch its own strikes on neighboring Gulf states, aiming missiles and drones at Western military bases there and at civilian targets.
This, despite the Gulf states' repeated message to Iran and the world, this is not our war. Jamal Fares al-Rowaei, Bahrain's ambassador to the UN, spoke at the Security Council last week, representing all the Gulf states, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. Here he is through an interpreter.
We strongly reject using the countries of the region to score points or to expand the conflict.
Scoring points is not how Iran sees it. The Gulf states host Western military bases, and Iran says those bases are legitimate targets. The World's Jerry Haddon reports on the delicate balance Gulf states have sought between ensuring their own security and keeping regional peace.
Gulf state leaders say they've been surprised twice since the war began. First, that it started at all. The U.S. and Israel didn't tell them beforehand. And second, that Iran fired at them in retaliation.
There were no warning or arrangement. Qatar was surprised by these unjustified attacks.
This was Qatar's foreign ministry spokesman, Mahed Al-Ansari, speaking on Qatar television last week. This is the English translation.
The foreign ministry has summoned Saleh Al-Abadi, ambassador of Iran. We expressed to him its total rejection to these aggression that is complete violation to the international law.
Qatar has had open, if cautious, relations with Iran. In recent years, it has sometimes played intermediary with the West over Iran's contentious nuclear program. Now, Qatar says, it feels betrayed. For its part, Iran has long been wary of Qatar and the other Gulf states, in part because of those Western military bases. Gulf states invited them in after the 1991 Gulf War. The West got to keep a closer eye on global oil supplies. The Gulf states got protection from, among others, Iran under the hardline Ayatollahs. Gulf state leaders insist those bases will not be used for offensive operations. But Alex Fatanka, director of the Middle East Institute in Washington, says Iran doesn't buy that.
One of the last speeches of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei before he died was, if Iran is attacked, it will be a regional war. And the Iranians had said they're not going to be able to reach all the way to the United States, but they're going to reach U.S. interests here. And that's exactly what they're doing. So this had not been one of those cases where anyone could claim to be surprised.
Fatanka says the U.S. may not be launching bombing sorties from its bases in the Gulf, but for Iran, even indirect support is a threat.
For the Iranians, the minimum will do. A minimum meaning that there are radars, there are military installations, there are command and control centers located in these countries, and therefore these countries become targets.
Fatanka says the Iranian government is now fighting for its life. If it had any friends in the Gulf 2 weeks ago, he says, those friendships no longer matter. Some Gulf state officials refer to Iran's approach to the conflict as scorched earth. The aggression has them quietly fuming at the U.S. They're struggling to understand the endgame in Iran as the attacks against them continue, but they're not likely to condemn the U.S. Tamara Al-Zarkat is a researcher with the Center for Strategic Studies at the University of Jordan in Amman. She says Iran's, quote, reckless attacks on the Gulf states have convinced them that they need the West more than ever.
And furthermore, Tehran used to attack a civilian goals, not necessarily a military goal. So that will reduce the feel of regret that they do not want these spaces in their country.
Anyway, what choice do they have, says Raphael Cohen, a senior political analyst at the RAND Corporation. Cohen says Saudi Arabia aside, the tiny monarchies may be fabulously wealthy, but militarily, they're outmuscled across the region.
These are small countries in a really bad neighborhood. So you want to build up your own capabilities. But at the end of the day, there's a limit to how far you can push that.
For the Gulf states to get back to business as usual, Cohen says, they need a protector.
That's a challenge, right? Are they frustrated with the United States? No doubt. The question is, if you all put yourself in the shoes of a Gulf state, you know, you still will have Iran right on your border. Who exactly do you align with?
Not with the Chinese, Cohen says, who've shown no interest in sending military hardware or advisors to the Gulf. As for the Russians, he says, they're bogged down in Ukraine. And besides,
really be better off if you were defending yourself with Russian hardware? I don't really think so.
So for the foreseeable future, the Gulf states will have to rely on the U.S. and to some degree Europe for security, a security that's being put to the test each day of this war. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Five members of Iran's women's national soccer team have just been granted asylum by the Australian government. It is the latest turn in a dramatic saga that began right before one of the team's televised matches in the Asian Women's Cup last week. The Iranian national anthem started to play, and none of the players sang along. Instead, they stared straight ahead, stone-faced. It was widely speculated to be an act of defiance, one that comes with huge risk, which those in the Iranian diaspora fully understood. Nazanin Noor is an Iranian-American actor and activist based in Los Angeles. She explained how those in the diaspora felt when they saw that scene play out.
Concerns grew for their safety after, you know, a state-controlled TV host went on air and basically said they should be treated as traitors. Their act was treasonous and that they should be punished harshly. More harshly, because it was wartime. So Iranian Australians went to the hotel where these girls were staying, tried to give them the information that, hey, if you guys fear for your lives and you want to seek asylum, there are pathways to do that here and we can help you. It was reported that hotel staff and the minders from the regime that were with these athletes, as they always are, were asking people to leave the lobby. They weren't allowing anybody to speak to these girls to get the information to them. But I guess some of the information did trickle into the girls. And we saw as of yesterday, five of them were able to defect. They were able to make contact with the Australian government officials who then took them to a safe house and offered them humanitarian visas. And as of this morning, I've been told that I believe two other girls are reported to have started the process for the defection as well, bringing the total to seven.
Wow, the scene at the hotel that you described sounds really scary for these women.
It was very chaotic watching it this morning. I watched it a couple times and it just gave me chills because this is not the first time this has happened. Our athletes are under constant threat and surveillance in Iran. If they do return to Iran, their families have been threatened. Their bank accounts have been frozen. Property can be taken away from them. They've been imprisoned. We've had athletes that are executed. And so knowing that they were leaving everything they know behind because of how much they fear what could happen to them if they went back to their homeland, it's really heartbreaking.
So I want to get into a lot of what you just brought up there. But first of all, I mean, there was speculation around the significance of their silence during the national anthem. How did you read it?
I did read it the exact same way that it's a big act of protest. And maybe to others that are watching that are not Iranian, it may not seem like it's a big act of protest, but it really is. I felt the same watching it, and I worried for their safety too as soon as I saw that. And then when I saw the TV host on state-controlled television say what he said, that's when my alarm bell started sounding too. Mm. And that's when people started mobilizing. I had Iranian Australians contact me and ask me to get the word out, and were giving me information directly from the ground there. And so with the effort of really wonderful people in Australia, the Australian government, the global community, and the diaspora worldwide, there was petitions that were being passed around. As we saw, President Trump got involved with making it public. So I believe all of that pressure helped make this a global news story and get these women the help they needed.
So Nazanin, the Iranian state TV host, is one mirror of the regime. But what do we know about the Iranian government's reaction to the team silence during the anthem?
Well, we saw that thing from the TV host. Then we saw that Mehdi Taj, who was the head of the Iranian Football Federation, he also is a former IRGC commander, reportedly, he was scheduled to fly to Australia just a couple days ago to get these women to come back, to ensure that they come back, which means it'll be under threat. And the Australian government denied him that visa. So the women's affairs representative for the Football Federation was sent instead. And she spoke to the media and she said something along the lines of, you know, these women's families could be in trouble, or their families are waiting for them, you know, so we want to bring them all back home. And then this morning, somebody from the regime also went on television, I believe, or gave a statement to the press saying that the U.S. and Israel and people showing concern, like President Trump showing concern for these women, is hypocrisy, considering that they're bombing the country right now, and that we will welcome these girls back home with open arms, which I also took that as ominous because we know how they treat not only just regular Iranian civilians, but athletes at large. And athletes themselves have gone on record, ones that have defected, to talk about the immense pressure and control that they're under. I have a good friend who competed for Iran's national team over a decade ago, and he's reiterated the exact same stories. We have minders. We're not allowed to fraternize with the opposite sex. They control what we say to the media. Everybody's watched and everybody is surveilled. So when I saw that statement this morning of, we're welcoming you, or we're waiting for you with open arms, I took that as a threat, actually.
So, I mean, what happens to people who go back after something like this? And what do you mean when you said earlier the punishment would be harsher because this is wartime?
The act of treason, or being under the guise of colluding or collaborating or supporting actions of the U.S. and Israel, who are the Islamic Republic's biggest enemies, could carry a death sentence, right? So these women weren't charged with that per se, but going on television and implying or insinuating that they are treasonous and that they should be treated as such, that's cause for fear, because they could be charged with those things. And you never know what could happen. We've had athletes that have been executed, like champion wrestler Navid Afkari in 2019, Mohamed Mehdi Karami in 2023 after the Women Life Freedom Movement. He was a national karate champion. So the precedent is there.
So after the team did not sing the national anthem, they did come back at another match and did sing. There was also speculation about that. The assumption had been that they were forced to sing the anthem a second time. What do we actually know about that?
Yeah, I mean, there was no official statement given because, of course, it's not like the coach or any players could really come out and tell us the whole story. Maybe we'll hear from the girls in Australia that if and when they decide to speak to the press. But it's widely believed that, yes, as soon as that state TV person went on air and made that threat, and the minders that are with them likely also reminded them, hey, you guys better not do that again. And then next match, sure, we saw them sing the anthem.
Hmm. So what about the rest of the team? Are they planning to go back to Iran, and would that be their own choice?
Well, we don't know how much of it is their own choice and how much of it is out of fear. And everybody's livelihoods, their families, their friends, their homes, everything is back there. It's not like this was a planned defection from what we know. And so, as I understand this morning, a representative from the Australian government, I think, said that the remaining girls were put on a flight that's going to Malaysia. And then from there, they're going to be taken back to Iran.
I gather you have family in Iran. How are they doing right now?
I do. I have a lot of family in Iran. Unfortunately, our text messages aren't being delivered to them, but I have family in various cities and they are able to call out for short bursts of time. Same thing that happened during the last regime imposed internet blackout from the January massacre and protests that have said, so-and-so and so-and-so are okay. We're in this city. Everybody here is physically safe and okay. So as far as I know, my family is physically safe. But it's a scary, scary time. They, of course, have been hearing and are in some of the cities that are being bombarded. So it's a scary time. It's an uncertain time. There's still people in Iran who have this hope. They're so desperate for change. They've tried everything to bring this regime down with their bare hands and nothing's worked because they're always met with military grade weapons and repression and execution. Some people think this might be the only way out. So people have fear mixed with some hope right now.
Iranian actor Nazanin Noor spoke to us from Los Angeles. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It has been called the biggest espionage scandal in Austria in decades. A former Austrian intelligence officer is currently on trial, accused of spying for Russia. He denies the charges. From Vienna, The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports the case has drawn international attention to Russian espionage activities in Austria and put a spotlight on the country's remarkably lax laws on spying.
And it's the first question I have for you. How many spies operate in Vienna at the moment? Any guesses?
Jasha Novak, a tour guide in Vienna, is taking us through the city's long, shady history of espionage.
50.
50, okay.
100.
100, okay.
300.
300, okay. So these are very low guesses. The estimate says that there are 7,000 spies operating in Vienna at the moment. But nobody really knows, of course, because no clever spy will ever tell you that he or she's a spy, of course.
Unofficially, Vienna is known as the city of spies. After the Second World War, Austria adopted a policy of military neutrality when the alliance between the Soviet bloc and the West broke down. Vienna, which sits in the heart of Central Europe, became a convenient listening post for intelligence agents from both sides. Several spy movies have been set here, like the classic thriller The Third Man with Orson Welles.
I never knew the old Vienna before the war with its Strauss music, its glamour and easy charm. I really got to know it in the classic period of the black market. Now the city, it's divided into four zones, you know, each occupied by a power, the American, the British, the Russian and the French.
But the city is also a major diplomatic hub with agencies like the United Nations and the International Atomic Energy Agency operating here. But maybe the biggest reason behind Vienna's reputation as a global hotspot of espionage...
In 1956, the Austrian Supreme Court ruled that espionage is legal in Austria. Basically, we don't care what other countries do to each other on Austrian soil. This is not of our concern.
But if you spy on Austria, that's when the authorities come knocking, as they did in the case of Egisto Ott, the former intelligence officer now on trial in Vienna. Ott is accused of sharing sensitive government information with Russia.
This case is very special, and I think it's the first case where you can see in a lot of details how Russian espionage works.
Anna Thalhammer is editor-in-chief of Profil, an investigative journalism magazine. This trial is bigger than just Austria, she says, because Ott is also alleged to have had links to Jan Marszalek. He's the former chief operating officer of Wirecard, a German payments company that collapsed in 2020 after a $2 billion accounting fraud was uncovered. Marszalek is believed to have fled to Moscow and is suspected of secretly working with Russian military intelligence. Anna Thalhammer has been reporting on allegations against both Ott and Marszalek for several years. And it's not been easy, she says.
There have been disinformation campaigns about me. They tried to destroy my integrity. So they said I'm having affairs with this and that investigator, and I'm a political person, and I'm bought by a party and stuff like that.
Last year, intelligence services told Thalhammer that it also appeared she was being spied on.
I was informed that this group spied on me. They followed me to my workplace, but also to my private home. They found out where I'm living and have been there for months.
Thalhammer is not the only journalist in Vienna who's found themselves at the center of a spy operation.
This group of operatives broke into my apartment in Vienna when I used to live there in 2022.
Krystal Grozhev, the former editor of the investigative outlet Bellingcat, was forced to flee Vienna a few years ago after living here for 2 decades. He had been tracking Jan Marszalek's movements when his flat was raided, he told The World last October.
They tried to actively steal the laptop, thinking that it contains all the secrets and all the whistleblower's tips and all the whatever they imagined was on that computer. One of my children was at home during the break-in, and it was super scary. That probably drove my decision to also live separately from my family so that I can protect them.
Last week, details about the Grozhev break-in were brought up in the trial here in Vienna. Some political parties, like the Liberals and the Greens, are calling for a parliamentary inquiry into Russian activities in Austria. But so far, little has happened. Austrian journalist Martin Staudinger says that could be because some lawmakers, in particular ones associated with the far-right Freedom Party, may be a little too cozy with the Kremlin.
There was kind of a friendship treaty between the Freedom Party and Russia in the noughties, I think. We have no smoking gun, but usually when something walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck.
Staudinger is deputy editor-in-chief of Falter, a weekly news magazine in Austria. When it comes to spying in Vienna, he says, it's not just the Russians who are at it.
You will find a structure, a white structure on the roof of the US embassy, which is glowing in red if you pointed it with a thermal camera.
In other words, you'll see all kinds of monitoring equipment linked to surveillance. It's not like the old days, Staudinger says, when agents would sit in Vienna's famous coffee houses spying on each other. I go to meet Dietmar Pichler in a coffee shop in the northwest of Vienna.
I'm a disinformation analyst. I'm also a subversion analyst. I'm head editor of Inwert.eu.
It's unlikely any spies come here, he says, although one man does sit behind us, reading a newspaper all the time we're there. Pichler says Austria has another problem that's maybe bigger than espionage.
We don't talk at all about agents of influence. This is a problem. This is a big taboo topic. Just to explain, agents of influence, people, they are not spies. They don't take information. They bring hostile information. So they bring propaganda and they lobby for authoritarian regimes.
And many of those agents of influence are in academic or political positions, he says, and end up on national television programs spouting pro-Kremlin propaganda. With all the attention on this spy trial, Austria is under pressure to tighten its espionage laws. The Justice Ministry said in January that a working group is being set up to examine what can be done. Back on the streets of Vienna, though, tour guide Jasha Novak isn't sure that'll come to much.
I do the tour since 2018. I've heard politicians talk about changing these things and nothing ever happened.
I don't think I'll need to change my tour, he says, anytime soon. For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Vienna.
Coming up, why it is so hard to get folks around the world to exercise.
It is very different to try to get political attention for an issue that is positive compared to as an issue that is negative.
In the meantime, drop and give me 20. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Haiti, private security forces hired by the Haitian government are using drones armed with explosives to target gangs in and around Port-au-Prince. A new report from Human Rights Watch finds that Haitian civilians, including children, are falling victim to drone attacks. Juanita Gobertus Estrada directs the Americas Division of Human Rights Watch. When we spoke this morning, I asked her what her group's investigation uncovered.
We were able to establish that the Haitian security forces, with the collaboration of a private military company called Vectus Global, have launched drone strikes armed with explosives that have resulted in the killing of at least 1,243 people since March last year until January this year. And as a result of those strikes, at least 43 adults who were not members in criminal groups and 17 children were executed. We are in a context of law enforcement, not armed conflict, and therefore Haitian authorities need to be specially cautious in the use of force.
And this is, as you have said, the Haitian authorities, the Haitian government, and private contractors they are working with who are using these drones.
That's correct. We were able to connect the drone strikes to a task force, a special task force that was established by Prime Minister Fils Aimé and that has operated with the support of this private company. And we were also able to establish that as a result of an interview given by the U.S. ambassador in Haiti, they confirmed that they gave license to Vectus Global to be able to provide security services in Haiti.
Vectus Global, this private security contractor you're saying, has been in some way authorized by the U.S. government to operate there.
That's correct.
Why are drones being used to target Haiti's gangs? Why use that weaponry specifically?
So the security situation in Haiti is quite dire. There was a desperate need, and there still is, for an effective and rights-respecting security policy that can protect Haitians from the attacks of gangs. It is very clear that to the current government, they see drones as an avenue for advantage in their fight against organized crime and gangs. The challenge, though, that they're facing is that because this is a scenario of law enforcement, we're talking about severely violent and well-armed gangs, but that operate in the middle of the civilian population in which you don't have an armed conflict, then all the authorities, both Haitian authorities, but also the international forces deployed on the ground, need to assure that the use of lethal force is really the last resort. And that is not what is happening with the use of these drones.
So you have a lot of civilians who are being killed in these drone strikes. Are these civilian deaths being investigated?
They are not. Part of the challenge is that, of course, the judiciary in Haiti is completely collapsed, not only with lack of capacity, but with very severe challenges of corruption. And so to be able to have an effective a security policy that is also right-respecting, there needs to be a parallel strengthening process of the capacity of the judiciary to be able to detain gang members without prioritizing the use of lethal force, not only against gang members, but most importantly, and what we've been able to document in this case, they're using lethal force that has directly impacted civilian population not involved in the gangs.
Is this sort of drone warfare legal?
It is not. This is the first case in which we've seen the application of drones armed with explosives in a law enforcement context. You need to assure that lethal force remains the last resort. So for drones to be legal in these sort of contexts, you need to assure that the members of the police or the private contractors guiding these drones assure that they give, for example, a voice announcement that this is the police, that they need to stop, for example, if they're running away. If they're going to use force, they should have the potential of using force that is less lethal before escalating into lethal force, and only if it is to protect the life of others, for example. That is certainly something that we're not seeing happening. What we're seeing is the direct and targeted use of explosives in drones, including to civilian population and children not involved in gangs.
That was Juanita Gobertus Estrada of Human Rights Watch. And now we have another view from Haiti.
mercenaries are dropping bombs on a regular basis.
That's Widlor Marincor in Port-au-Prince. In a voice memo he sent us this morning, he told us he lives just minutes away from where those bombs are falling.
The explosions are so close that my house shakes and the alarm of my car would ring because of the explosions.
Marincor is the editor of the Haitian news outlet Aibo Post in Port-au-Prince, and he tells us that this is not a sophisticated professional operation. The targeting, he says, suggests that it's someone striking areas where gang members are known to live without regard for other people who also live there.
The slums and the areas controlled by gangs are also places for impoverished people to live because they have nowhere else to go. We are talking about a record number of people displaced by gang violence.
We reached back out to Widlor Marincor to hear more about what it's like on the ground in Port-au-Prince right now.
If you are living today in Port-au-Prince, especially if you're living in gang-controlled areas, you can see the drones flying overhead. You can hear them, and these devices carrying explosives patrolling these areas. And sometimes they are dropped on places where they believe, or those conducting the operations believe, you know, have gang members.
So these drones are flying around constantly in the city, and sometimes they're just flying around and sometimes they drop explosives. Is that right? That sounds terrifying.
It is terrifying. I mean, I think it's two things. Drones are being used for surveillance, and the surveillance drones overhead are controlled sometimes by the gangs themselves. But they are also used increasingly by the authorities as part of their strategy to kill gang members.
I want to talk now about one family who lived in Port-au-Prince that your outlet, the Aibo Post, has profiled in recent days. This family fell victim to these drone strikes. Can I have you start by telling me where this family lived in Port-au-Prince? What kind of neighborhood was it?
This family lives in an impoverished place called Bel Air. It is one of these areas where you certainly have gang members, but you also have impoverished people who have nowhere to go.
So these neighborhoods, you're saying, are caught between the gangs and the law enforcement officials who are trying to control the gangs?
Exactly. Many of the people killed were not gang members. And this family, according to our own reporting and people we spoke to in the area, is practically decimated. The mother was wounded. Father was killed. Multiple other people inside this house were killed by the explosion. These people were not gang members.
Widlor, what is the name of this family and those who died?
Okay, so we have Reginald Milo. He's the father. We also have Reginald Fils Milo. He's the younger brother. Milienne Milo, it's a 13-year-old sister. And Jean Billiot Milo, the 32-year-old brother.
So the person who brought this story to you was the brother from this family who has lived outside of Haiti for a few years. Am I understanding right that his 21-year-old brother, his 32-year-old brother, his 51-year-old father, and his young sister, who was a teenager, were all killed? Do the surviving members of this family have any legal recourse? Is there anyone they could, for example, take to court to sue?
Today, this family do not know who dropped the drones, so they would not know who to sue. There is a lack of information from the state regarding who's ultimately responsible for these drone strikes. And on top of that, you also have a dysfunctional justice system that is, you know, historically unable to give justice to anyone, and certainly not this family.
Widlor Marincor is the editor of the Haitian news outlet Aibo Post in Port-au-Prince. It is widely understood that exercise is key to good health, and most countries in the world are trying to get their populations to exercise more. But globally, the percentage of people who get enough exercise has not increased in the past 20 years. A third of adults still do not get the recommended amount of physical activity. Epidemiologist Andrea Ramirez-Varela has been looking into why and published her findings this week in the journal Nature Health. She is an assistant professor at UT Houston School of Public Health. Welcome to the program, Dr. Ramirez-Varela.
Thank you so much, Caroline, for the invitation. I'm very excited to be here today.
So you found that most countries have stated goals of trying to get their populations to exercise more, but they are not working. Why not?
What we have found is that despite of a lot of effort in policy development and adoption, there is a gap with implementation. It means that all the plans that have been published and accepted as like a plan that governments want to follow have not been put into practice.
One of the reasons as to why that really jumped out to me in your paper was that you say there's a lack of political priority on getting people to exercise more, despite not exercising being as deadly as smoking. So why isn't there more of a political priority on this?
Well, because physical activity has very special characteristics in public health. So physical activity, first of all, is a positive behavior. So it is very different to try to get political attention for an issue that is positive compared to as an issue that is negative. So tobacco, alcohol use, poor nutrition will attract a lot of attention because they are negative behaviors that we want to combat, as opposed to physical activity, which is a positive behavior. So that is something that we want to promote. It is nice to have, but not need to have in the view of some policymakers and governments. That is something that we really need to work on to make sure physical activity gets political prioritization. And that means that governments will put them in their agendas, but also assign resources, so money and personnel, to make sure that the plans are implemented.
Mm. You also write that the scope of benefits of exercise is not fully understood. So people understand, you know, maybe the cardiovascular benefits, but not some other ones. Can you just list a couple of those that are often overlooked?
Exactly. Physical activity has a lot of evidence. So we know that mental health has a big effect of physical activity. Also, cancer prevention, control, and quality of life for survivors. Also, we know not only cardiovascular disease, but infectious disease. So we found out during the pandemic that those who were active and met the physical activity recommendations had a reduced risk of dying of COVID-19. So physical activity has a lot of health benefits and also benefits outside of health. So physical activity can contribute to increased social support and social equity. Physical activity can contribute to economic productivity. We know that kids that are active can reach a higher potential employment in their lives.
You point to Colombia as a country that has had some success here in boosting exercise rates. Can you give me a bit of an overview of what the government did there, why it worked so well?
Of course. So one of the key reasons is that in 1991, the Constitution established sports and recreation as a right for all Colombians. And that single action made it a national level, state level, and municipal level responsibility and priority. And after that, Colombia has been able to put together a very strong policy infrastructure that has allowed for economic sustainability. So all the plans that have been put together have sustainability in the long term because there are direct funding sources from, for example, taxes. Another example that is wonderful and is iconic from Colombia is the Ciclovia, the open streets program, in which we close streets to cars and then people can walk and bike and do whatever activity they want every Sunday and holidays. And this happens in the biggest cities in the country. This started in the 1970s, so it has been running for about 50 years. It's more than 100 kilometers of streets closed to cars.
Well ahead of when other cities started to do that, like post-pandemic.
Yeah, that's correct. They can walk, they can bike, they can skate, they can go with their babies, with their dogs, with the entire family can just go out. So it is a great moment for families to exercise together, to do their physical activity. So it's like a really nice party every Sunday and every holiday in the country.
I know that you are from Colombia. You worked there for much of your career. How much did physical activity in Colombia increase because of some of these changes?
So the evidence that we have shows that leisure time physical activity increased from 19% to almost 23% in 2015, which was the latest survey that was applied. So, and this is leisure time physical activity. And we know that this leisure time physical activity has a lot of health benefits as opposed to other forms of physical activity. So this is evidence from the Decennial Sports Plan, evaluating time from 2009 to 2019.
You mentioned that leisure time sports, so like recreation, is especially beneficial to our health rather than activity that is required by our jobs. Can you explain why recreation is more beneficial than, say, laboring at work?
Well, because it depends on the context, right? So we know that in low and middle income settings, sometimes people have to do physical activity just because they don't have any other alternative. So let's say like strenuous labor, like lifting very heavy boxes or just using your body to, let's say, clean or do strenuous activities or just like say in a crop or in an open space, that will inherently cause more injuries or increase the risk of you getting a specific occupational injury or disease. So that is why we always prefer to promote physical activity that the individual can choose. So it is leisure time physical activity or like free time to relax and to really enjoy, as opposed to having very long work activities.
Is that because work can push your body beyond what is safe for it to do? Sometimes it's very repetitive and high stress.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, exactly. So it's more like the injuries, and also because we want to promote the quality of life and the mental health benefits of when you are able to choose leisure time physical activity.
Before I let you go, if you had to give governments one very short piece of advice on how to get populations to exercise more, what would it be?
I would say implement big P policy means meaning implementing laws and taxes to regulate physical inactivity. That would be the most important action they can do to have a population impact and to increase physical activity levels in their people.
Andrea Ramirez-Varela of UT Health Houston School of Public Health. She spoke to me today about her research.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's a troubling chapter of American history, the incarceration of more than 120,000 U.S. residents of Japanese descent during World War II. The camps were ringed with barbed wire, and most of the people sent to them were U.S. citizens. As KQED's Keith Mizuguchi reports, some survivors of the internment camps see ICE arrests and increasing political division and worry that's creating an environment that could lead to the same situation.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced.
President Roosevelt called the attack on Pearl Harbor a date which will live in infamy. It launched the U.S. into World War II and also brought a wave of fear along the West Coast, where thousands of Japanese Americans lived.
Right after the attack on Pearl Harbor, there was the invoking of the Alien Enemies Act to round up Japanese immigrants.
That's Brian Nia, a public historian for Densho, an organization that chronicles the story of Japanese-American incarceration. Just a few months later came the executive order.
John DeWitt, general in charge of the West Coast, he gave us 1 week to pack up and move and get rid of our possessions.
Sam Mihara and his family lived in San Francisco at the time. After being taken to an assembly center in Southern California, he and his family were sent to Cody, Wyoming.
No insulation. That first winter, it got down to minus 28 degrees. It was horrible.
In Sacramento, Kiyo Sato and her family were going through similar suffering. The oldest of nine children, Sato recalls being forced into incarceration in Poston, Arizona.
When that train started moving, I just broke down. I just couldn't hold it any longer, and I was crying and crying. Yeah, nobody came to say this was a mistake, you can go home.
The survivors we spoke with were children during the incarceration. But in many cases, things were even more difficult for their parents. Many weren't born in the U.S., and they were taught to not disobey orders.
You've heard it, ladies and gentlemen, and we're here in the Time Star newsroom with a traveling microphone. The war is over. The Japanese have surrendered.
When the war ended, things did not get back to normal for Japanese-American families, especially in California. Again, historian Brian Nia.
The people who returned to the West Coast typically had a much more difficult time, especially in the first year or two. There was a spate of these Knight Rider incidents where people would go around shooting into the houses that Japanese Americans were returning to.
During his presidential campaign, Donald Trump threatened to invoke the Alien Enemies Act again if he was elected, and he did so in March. Sacramento Congresswoman Doris Matsui was born in the camp at Poston. She sees similarities today to how her family was treated.
My family lived through what happens when this fear goes unchecked. There are deeply troubling parallels. You see what ICE is doing. They're tearing families apart.
And Kiyo Sato agrees.
It is just absolutely terrible. Terrible, terrible what is happening to the people.
At a recent Day of Remembrance event in San Jose's Japantown neighborhood, community organizations talked about the importance of supporting immigrants. Reiko Nakayama is chairperson of the Nihon Machi Organizing Committee.
This is not an isolated event, that it has historical background, and the original Alien Enemies Act has been invoked yet again, and it's extremely dangerous for our civil liberties.
Perhaps more than others, Congresswoman Matsui has some power to enact change. And despite being part of the minority party in Washington, she's not ending the fight.
I've never seen as much vigor or just in a sense of fortitude and fight as I've seen amongst my colleagues. We're all in this, and we know that this is very fundamental to who we are as Americans.
And for Japanese Americans, that fight gives the country a chance to not repeat history. For The World, I'm Keith Mizuguchi, San Francisco.
The late Icelandic musician Jóhann Jóhannsson was a fixture on the country's pop music scene in the 2000s. He was also a skilled composer of classical music and film scores.
Jóhannsson was nominated for an Academy Award for his score to the 2014 film The Theory of Everything about physicist Stephen Hawking and his wife, Jane Hawking.
I met Jóhannsson in Reykjavik in 2003 when he was part of a quartet making futuristic dance sounds. At the time, he told me his philosophy about the machinery of music, playing on old recycled keyboards and organs, was very Icelandic, in the same way the country thinks of sheep. You don't waste anything.
Icelanders have used every part of the sheep, you know, and when you kill a sheep, you know, you use the fleece, you know, for clothes, and you use intestines for fuel or whatever, and you know, we even eat the head, you know, and the brains.
Jóhannsson died in 2018, but his music lives on, including in a new album by the German-Japanese classical pianist Alice Sara Ott. Ott was inspired by Johansson's intimate sound and its contrast to the dissonance of the modern world.
She immersed herself in the sub-Arctic world Jóhann Jóhannsson used to occupy to make her new album. Ott explains on her YouTube channel how she took that feeling into the studio in Iceland of Grammy-nominated producer Bergur Thorisson.
For 5 days, I've walked each morning through the cold sea wind, accompanied by the sound of seagulls, to Bergur's beautiful recording studio by the water. And there, in this warm and cozy space, I've spent hours playing and recording Jóhann Jóhannsson's music.
Alice Sara Ott's just-released recording is titled Jóhann Jóhannsson Piano Works. It includes both his classical compositions and film music. We leave you with Ott's own interpretation of Johansson's theme to The Theory of Everything, captured as Jóhannsson would surely have appreciated on a vintage upright piano.
World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. If you miss us on the radio, our reporting can be found anytime at theworld.org. And on our YouTube channel, just look for The World News Radio. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for letting us be part of your day today.
Is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.